Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and Robin Martinez is here with me. Good morning, Robin. How are you?
Great. How are you, Joyce?
Good, thanks. So today we're going to talk about resources for people with rare diseases. And if you are involved with von Hippel-Lindau disease, it will be directly involving for you. But if you're not, if you don't even know how to spell VHL, which is true of most people, that what I want you to listen for is how the group of patients can actually help each other by pooling their information, learning from each other, and learning from their physicians, and scouting out information all over the world and pulling it all together. And that's basically what the VHL Alliance has done. So our guest today is the editor of the current revision, version 5 of the VHL Handbook. I'd like you to meet Suzanne Nylander from the VHL Alliance. Good morning, Suzanne. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So the VHL Alliance has been around since 1993, and this is the fifth edition, so it's grown over the years. So tell us what has been added to the current edition.
Well, with the current edition of the handbook, we have tried to actually put it in an order to make it very easy for the patient to, or whoever's looking at it, if they want to show it to, you know, a friend, family member, or even a physician, to look at it very quickly to find answers to specific questions. Of course, we start off with an overview of what is VHL, because that's often the number one question that people have. And then because it is talked about as a form of cancer or cancer susceptibility gene, then really you get to the question, what is cancer? Because there are a lot of varying definitions of that as well. So what we tried to do in the very first section was do a good overview of VHL, including how people get VHL and how to get tested and how to get screened. And then in the next section, we go into more details about individual organ manifestations of VHL, so that if you want to look up something in a lot more detail, you know, maybe about the brain, maybe about the kidneys, maybe about the eye, you can look that up in that section 2 of the handbook. So really trying to put it in a little bit different order to hopefully make it easier to look at a little bit at a time. And then one of the other things that we did was we expanded the what we call healthy living section. We were actually very fortunate being located here in Boston. We get interns in over the summer, and we had one fantastic intern who was a genetic counseling student. And she wrote the basic format for the healthy living section that, you know, we made a few revisions to and things, but that's basically was our inspiration for including that as a separate section in the book. And one of the other emphasis of the new edition of the handbook is how to talk about VHL with your family, how to communicate, how to talk to children about VHL, how to talk to teens about VHL. So some very specific things there. But, of course, that's really how to talk to a teen or child about any type of rare disorder. I mean, it's not specific to VHL, but, you know, those are common questions. So what we've really been able to do in this handbook is use that wealth of knowledge that's been gained since 1993 with knowing the types of questions that people often have and trying to incorporate as many answers to those as possible in the handbook.
Right.
And I know that suppose we should we probably should talk about where the handbook is available, since it is a free resource.
Sure. Yeah, the handbook can be downloaded from the VHL Alliance website. The VHL Alliance website is vhl.org, and if you want to go straight to the download section for the handbook, it's vhl.org/handbook, and that'll take you right to where you register to download the handbook. There are hard copies available, too. Those are separate in the store section of the VHL Alliance website.
Right, and it's also available on Amazon.
Right.
Correct.
This is a terrific resource.
Right, and we find that, you know, we certainly wanted to make it available to download for people because, you know, people around the world access the handbook, you know, so they need to be able to download it to find answers to their questions. But it's helpful to have a hard copy as well. Sometimes people just see it, you know, if you're going to take it into a physician's office with you, for example. It's just seen as more real by the physician if it's a physical book instead of something that you've printed out on your from your home computer. Same information, obviously, but it's just a different perception.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think eventually people will get used to having downloads be as reputable as printed materials, but it hasn't happened yet.
True. I mean, and the printed material does let you leaf through it sometimes more quickly than you can through the electronic version. And, you know, you can also see all of the physicians and other professionals involved in both creating and double-checking the material in the handbook right in the front, you know, so that lends some authority to it as well to make everybody comfortable with the information that's in the handbook. One of the challenges, of course, for anybody with a rare disease is getting diagnosed. And just because there's over 7,000 rare diseases, most physicians are never going to have seen someone with VHL. So that's why, you know, you may need to bring in a resource like this to your general practitioner because, for example, you want to have DNA testing ordered to see if you do have VHL. You may have a family member that was diagnosed but that doesn't live close by and you want to go to your local physician. So this can help answer a few questions like that and help make that happen a little bit more easily for the patient.
Right. So with any, as you say, with any rare disease, the first challenge is diagnosis. The second one is finding a doctor who knows what to do about your condition. And even though it may look like some of the things that happen in the general population, the strategies for dealing with it in someone with a genetic propensity could be quite different. One of the things, for example, is the kidney cancer that occurs in VHL, even though it is regular clear cell renal cell carcinoma and would respond in pretty much the same way to surgical therapies for kidney cancer that would be normal for someone in the general population, the strategy is different. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the very important things that we are always trying to get across to people. You know, I respond to our social media posts as well, and that's one of the issues that patients have. You know, you'll go in to see even a specialist, and if they don't realize that you have VHL, then they may want to treat your kidney tumor like you would what's called a sporadic tumor, one that just the same type of tumor, but one that occurs in the general population. And VHL, because it is a propensity to have the tumors occur again and again, needs to be treated differently. So instead of, you know, treating it very aggressively, you know, you definitely don't want a doctor that's, oh, you've got a tumor in your kidney, let's just remove that kidney. Very important not to do in VHL, but to actually have a much more conservative treatment to the point where a lot of the tumors that are seen are actually followed until they reach a certain size in order to minimize the number of surgeries that a VHL patient gets over their lifetime and to preserve kidney function for as long as possible as well. So it is important that, you know, you might think, well, I'm going to see a kidney specialist. Isn't that good enough? As Joyce was mentioning, not really, because VHL needs to be approached differently. And that is explained for each organ in the handbook, what the specific approach is for that organ and why it's different from what the approach would be, even if it's an identical tumor or lesion in the general population.
Right.
I think people don't realize that just because it looks like a duck and it sounds like a duck and it walks like a duck and whatever, that it isn't necessarily a duck. You know, that these tumors look exactly like tumors from other causes, sporadic tumors, as you said, but they are very different.
Right. Now, that's very true, and it's really because of this genetic change that for most people with VHL is in all of their cells. So in the kidney, it's in all of their kidney cells, that there's already one mutation in the VHL gene. The second mutation causes the tumor. So you can see in someone with no mutations that two mutations may only happen, you know, once in your lifetime. In somebody with VHL, it's going to happen more often and also earlier. So that's really the reason for the different approach. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and the kidney lesions or the kidney tumors are a good example, because most people that, you know, any type of a tumor is discovered that has the potential to become malignant, it's usually removed as early as possible. VHL gives researchers a very unique opportunity to observe how tumors change over time and what may possibly influence tumor growth. And that's one of the other exciting things that the VHL Alliance is working on is a patient data bank to take a look at that, because there's not very many conditions where tumors are allowed to grow over time to the point where they reach a certain size. So that's one of the other interesting projects that we're working on. And that patients
right.
have the opportunity to participate in.
Right. So this handbook has grown over time through the contribution of many, many patients. And as you say, now you're formally collecting that information in a database so that,
right.
that you as an organization can learn from it, but also that there's a base of information to share with the researchers that may reveal some interesting things that we just really hadn't noticed before because we didn't have enough aggregate data. So do you have a couple of things like that you could point to and share with us today?
Sure. Yeah, the interesting one that we've found so far, we don't know its implications or the reasons behind it at this point, is the association of poor oral health with VHL, which nobody expected to see that. It was one of those things where, you know, as soon as we had a few hundred people in the data bank, I was just looking through the aggregate pie chart data, which is actually something individual patients who participate can do themselves. We give them the opportunity once they've completed answering a survey and, you know, so they've put in their answers. They can look at a tab that says visualize all responses, and as long as there's at least 10 answers in there, it puts out pie charts or bar graphs, and so they can see some of the same stuff. It's immediate information that's updated continuously. So that's what led us to find that people with VHL, they brush their teeth and they go to the dentist, but they have you know, more problems with dry mouth, sores inside the mouth, cavities, needing crowns, needing root canals, and at younger ages than you would expect. Now, we don't know the cause, but that's the kind of information that you can find out that nobody knew before. Patients actually got together and shared their information, which is the purpose of the data bank.
There's some interesting reports out now about people with gum disease who have significant problems with dental health, maybe having more or more severe pancreatic cancer, stomach problems, things like that, because you're swallowing all that bacteria. So I'd be interested to know if the severity of dental health problems influences the severity of some of those visceral things in DHL.
Right. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's something that we hope to learn as well. We're actually working on updating some of the questions in the data bank. It's meant to be not a one-time thing that patients participate in, but a longitudinal study, which means putting in your information at least annually. And it's also a living document in that we're going to be looking at how people respond and maybe starting to ask questions, more questions about one area, less about another, depending on what we learn as we go. So,
right.
But we don't have all that information yet to take a look at it. The other thing is that, of course, the data bank is kind of a jumping off point for true in-person clinical research, because researchers can apply to the VHL Alliance and say that they're interested in studying a particular topic. And then if their topic is approved by our Clinical Advisory Council, then they will be given access to a certain amount of de-identified data in the data bank, which will allow an alert to be sent out from the Alliance to any patients that the researcher might be interested in contacting. Then what we do, the next step is the patient contacts the researcher. We don't have the researcher contact the patient. So that you do have the opportunity, if you want to, possibly participate in an in-person clinical study, because that'll be needed to follow up on some of the kind of tantalizing leads that we get from the data bank.
Right, and we should reinforce that point, that you're communicating with the patient. You're not putting the patient in direct contact with the researcher. It's up to the patient to choose whether or not they want to contact the researcher, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. The researcher will not know the individual patient information.
So this is great.
The
and the kind of thing that you're doing, I think, is really excellent and is just one example. There are many organizations now that are putting patient databases together in an effort to collect the information. And then at the other end, you've got this handbook that's actually delivering some consolidated information, helpful things on how to maintain your health, how to live a healthy life, how to stay engaged and look forward. Because so many times with rare diseases, people begin to feel hopeless. And it's really important to see that there are ways to stay healthy and in the workforce and enjoying life, even though you have some challenges along the way, as everybody does, but that it's possible to manage and move forward.
Right, right, exactly. That's one of the keys of the handbook, is to get the information out there to allow people to manage VHL. So for that reason, you know, right in the very first chapter, we include not just diagnosis, but an overview of some of the typical treatments and then the screening guidelines, so that it's right up front, so that you can see, you know, if, like, for example, if your child is diagnosed with VHL and the child is the first person in the family that you know of that has it, you know, you might feel pretty lost. Wow, what can I do? And you can get to that very quickly in the handbook and say, okay, here's the steps I should follow. And one of the other resources that, of course, we have on our website, which we just redid to make it even easier for patients to use, are clinical care centers. These are medical centers around the world that have physicians that are familiar with treating VHL, so that you can find a group of specialists, because that's the other thing that's unique about VHL is you can't have like one doctor that's your single VHL specialist, because it affects enough different organs in most people that you really need a group of specialists to work together to manage VHL. So we've made that simple with the clinical care centers.
Right. Frequently when people are dealing with cancer, it's a particular cancer. It's a pancreatic cancer, or it's a kidney cancer, or it's something else. But it's usually one particular organ site. And when you have one of these genetic syndromes like VHL or tuberous sclerosis or neurofibromatosis or so many others, it's often, or I should say usually, will affect more than one organ system. And maybe one came to the attention of the medical community first, but the other one could be lurking in the background. And if you're unaware of that, then you're sort of unprotected. But this kind of information warns you that you need to keep an eye on the other organ systems that are potentially involved, and how to do that, and how to react if you do find something. Hopefully early, because things are usually treated more successfully when they're early. Once things have metastasized, the ball game is a lot more complicated.
Right, or even with, the most of the tumors in VHL are actually what's termed benign, but that doesn't mean that they can't have, devastating effects on an individual. The best examples of those are, in the brain and spinal cord, also in the eye, where those won't metastasize, but again, you want them treated as early as possible so that you don't have a loss of function. And they are controllable in most cases if they're treated early.
Right. The terms benign and malignant are a little bit misleading. I mean, malignant is bad. We know that. Benign, though, when you talk about someone has a benign countenance or something, you mean that they're sort of friendly, they're nice, they're pleasant. Well, benign tumors, all it means is that they are not likely to metastasize. They're not likely to spread anyplace else. But they can still do a lot of damage to you right where they stand. So benign tumors are still tumors and are still have to be dealt with carefully.
Right, right. And that's one of the things we point out and why we've got a little section in the handbook, called What is Cancer? It's basically an abnormal growth of cells. These tumors could be benign, as Joyce was mentioning. One of the issues with benign tumors, though, even though they don't move out of that particular organ, a benign tumor in a confined space, like the brain, can have a lot of bad effects if it's not taken care of, just because of the space it takes up, and that puts pressure on the brain, which causes symptoms and issues.
When we hear the word benign, we tend to think harmless, but that's not what it means in terms of tumors.
Correct. Right. So that's one of those things that we define right off in the handbook so that people understand. It's on page 2 in the handbook, so that it's right up front and center, because there's so much, there's a lot of misconceptions around cancer, and it's partly how the word is used. A lot of people use cancer only to refer to malignant tumors, but we feel it's more accurate to use it to refer to any type of abnormal growth of cells, whether it's technically benign or whether it's malignant.
So this is, VHL is one of the more complex kinds of hereditary cancer syndromes, but there are plenty of others. And Robin, you're more familiar with many of the other ones. I know HLRCC has a book that's growing. Are there other cancer syndromes that have done this kind of organization of the information to try to help people stay healthy?
Well, there are lots of different groups that are trying to get mobilized and get together. For example, Lynch syndrome. just a great number of hereditary type things that can influence people to develop cancers in different organs. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are among the better known ones because of celebrity support for them. But people don't realize that BRCA1 and 2 can also cause pancreatic cancer and lots of other types of cancer, not just in the breasts and ovaries. So there's a lot going on with all this genetic stuff. People are getting more and more informed about it, and what worries me is that they may become overwhelmed, that there are so many syndromes and so many places that can be affected. How do you figure out what's going on with you? How do you figure out where you're affected? And the best answer to that is you need an expert in that field.
Right. And the key to all of it is getting an accurate diagnosis. And so if you don't feel that you have the right diagnosis, do pursue that with your doctor. Maybe do some DNA testing, because for many of these diseases, the only fine distinction that can be drawn is through the DNA analysis. I know sometimes insurers are not really excited about paying for it, but if it keeps you from getting the wrong treatment and if it preserves your life and your quality of life, it's definitely worthwhile, even if you have to pay for it out of your pocket. So getting that accurate diagnosis and then getting the information that's targeted to your particular syndrome is very, very important. So I really want to applaud the work that you've done, Suzanne. This is great. And the organization, too, for pulling together the not only the patient information, but also the wisdom of the various doctors around the world who've been treating this disease for a long time. And I know you've had to arbitrate among differing opinions from different doctors on how to approach this thing, but I think you've done an excellent job.
Well, thank you. I wanted to point out to the listeners as well that genetic counselors are a great resource. You know, really anyone that's considering getting DNA testing done should be working with a genetic counselor. They can help
right.
you determine, you know, which tests you might need to have, help you, you know, interpret the results. And, of course, if it's inherited, then that has some implications for family members as well. You know, if someone in the family tests positive, for example, with VHL, it's what's called a dominant condition. That means it does not skip generations. So, you know, let's say the father is test positive for VHL. Well, he needs to inform his siblings, you know, even his parents, if they're still alive. Needs to inform his siblings. They should be tested for the same mutation, and of course all of the children should be tested for that same mutation. So that's where a genetic counselor can be very helpful, because that can be, you know, a difficult conversation to have with family members, and they can certainly help you have the conversation and also explain that the testing, in the case of VHL anyway, is easier for the subsequent family members, because they only need to test for a single known mutation, not
right.
every possible mutation.
Right, and the genetic counselors are really good at doing that. We're down to the last 1 minute, so I just wanted to sum up a little bit. Robin, is there something you'd like to sum for us before we leave?
The only thing I was thinking we missed is the social media aspect. That the VHL Association is on Facebook, and some people find Facebook more approachable than almost anything else online. So if you just look up VHL, you'll find lots of different regional associations, which are all affiliated with the main association, and the main association is the biggest group on there.
Great. So
right.
thank
we,
you very much.
We've got a VHL Alliance group. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for being with us. And thank you, Robin, as always. And thanks to everybody for listening in today. We hope that you've gained something from this conversation. And if you do have a VHL association, please go to vhl.org/handbook and pick it up. It's a great resource. And thanks, everybody. We'll see you again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.